This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
How much the kind of errancy and disorientation and the kind of almost impossibility to cartographize Moscow. How much in your experience, your students, does this go back to like a Debord movement, situationism, in which this was like a really big deal in Debord to kind of pick up from Breton's Nadia, to pick up from Aragon's Paysan de Paris, to get into these kinds of new experiences of errancies, particularly in to articulate a kind of deconstruction of a relationship of center to periphery. I mean, one of the most amazing statements in the Moscow Diary is that Moscow is always on the outskirts of itself. Mm-hmm. Right? That at every point in Moscow, we are kind of revisiting a kind of a permanent resurgence of the peasant village, of in fact, the huge kind of plain of the steppes that is actually coming into Moscow that is attempting, you know, through St. Basil's or whatever, to kind of erect a fortress-like notion of a center, which at every point, and I mean, I think Benjamin is really amazing on this, that kind of piddles out into periphery, right? And Debord, you know, with even their kind of practices of, and the Italians were doing the same thing around Milan, right? You know, in the 70s, are trying to re-question a cartography, a city cartography of city of center versus periphery. I was this a conscious thing that when you were talking about sort of the relevance of this text to contemporary theories of porosity, which are basically a theory of movable thresholds. Benjamin is very, very big into Schwellenkunde, the science of thresholds, right?
Yeah.
And the swelling Schwellen of the threshold, right?
And also the power of the threshold.
The
right?
power yeah. of the threshold.
The mystery of the threshold.
And also he was a reader of Van Gennep, you know. Who is the great anthropological theorist of threshold experiences, which are the experiences of initiation and of passage, you know? So just want to reincorporate here the whole huge Benjamin notion
Palette.
Of passagen and yeah. of passage, you know? The city as a site of passages, right?
But, yes, thank you, Richard, for this reference to Debord. But you remember that one of the situationist exercises offered by Debord is you take a map of London and you walk in Paris. And so as you see what happens. It feels a little as if Benjamin
is taking a map of
another
Berlin,
map, and then was walking like the map of Paris, and was walking in Moscow.
But so
imaginary.
But what he misses in Moscow, and this is both in the diary and the essay for Buber's magazine, is it starts with, now I am back in Berlin, you alluded to this, and the streets are so clean, And what he loves in Moscow and in Naples and in Marseille, and this is this really weird conjunction that he makes between the septentrional, i.e. the northern, and the Mediterranean, is the overflow of the street, you know? And the street as precisely that crucial threshold area in which the privacy of the bourgeois intérieur and the publicity of the festival site and kind of chaotic commercial souk-like or bazaar-like site with all these stalls, right, in Moscow, right? The notion of the, not the store, but the stall, you know, which comes out of, you know, Breton's flea market and so on and so forth. But it's all ultimately about the street. And he says, you know, the experience of the street in Moscow, I don't know if this is still today true in Moscow, but at least in 2027, there was this threshold zone of the street with with vendors, with gypsies, with peasants, with all the kind of availability of toys and, you know, these not yet commodity fetishized objects. Remember, Benjamin is the son of a department store magnate, which takes all this street vendor stuff and puts it into, you know, Zola's Lady's Paradise, you know, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, how did this work with your students on
Moscovite,
the street?
As a Moscovite, I have to confess that there is one shocking line in Moscow Diary, absolutely killing any kind of Moscovite. It's like a sharp sword in my heart. But I entirely agree and I accept it. So Benjamin writes that in this imaginary, and here I want to elaborate a little bit on your idea of a reverse logic of center periphery.
Yeah.
So Benjamin writes on this imaginary Moscow is such an imaginary megapolis with all this provincial air. And here he absolutely kills us. It is a provincial, small village that imagines itself as a megapolis with the rhythmus of a megapolis. So there is this discrepancy even today.
He loves that.
And we love this too, but it's super sharp. And I think that this is the exact discrepancy that I would refer to. It's not the center to periphery, but it is imaginary to a second layer of imaginary, as we perceive ourselves.
This is your comment on the meta.
Yeah, that is my comment of what is center, what becomes center, what becomes a periphery. Yeah?
Was this part of your experience too? Or coming from where? Zagreb? Or? Is that where you come from?
I came to Moscow definitely from Zagreb through Belgrade, as I said. And having never been to Soviet Union before, and only once really after that, it was a puzzling experience, but also experience that was imbued with the power of the state. So I think one does not come to Moscow as one would. Well, I did not come to Moscow as I would come to some other place. And I wondered very much about that.
You're like going to Washington, D.C.?
Actually, that does not impress me that much. I apologize. So I think that one possibility for thinking about Benjamin's Moscow was the fantasy of it he had before the day when he arrived. And I am not sure what that might have been. It is very interesting also with his writing, I cannot quote, but several things that he contemplates in Italy and then executes elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the kind of hotness of an idea that then kind of needs a cold air for something to happen with it. I actually was inspired to read a few things that I did not know Benjamin wrote. So Berlin Childhood, around 1900, well, you know, the first sentence starts, "Begun in Poveromo, Italy, 1932, and extensively revised in 1938. Yeah. So for me, interesting work, or maybe you can tell us if you know, could be done about this starting here, finishing there, some space where the what is imaginative starts and where then experience and actual, quote-unquote, writing gets done.
So there are these two parallel capitals, which are Paris, capital of the 19th century, and Berlin, which could have been and may well have become the capital of the 20th and certainly the 21st century. Berlin, another weird place which models itself after Paris, but which is almost always a city that is the outskirts of itself, not yet finished, you know, still in elaboration. I don't know whether Benjamin could have seen this, but I mean, Benjamin was very. And then there are the Mediterranean cities. There are Benjamin's great texts on Marseille, on Genoa. Naples, and so Moscow actually triangulates very interestingly between these two models of the capital, which are Berlin and Paris, and these kind of Mediterranean peripheries. And what's really interesting is to see the way in which, as I briefly mentioned, is that Moscow is this kind of northern reply to a Mediterranean, and particularly, and here we have Asialasis and this Naples text, and at the core of, I mean, you mentioned porosity, and let me just quote this here. In relationship to contemporary theories of architecture, this is from the Naples texts, and let's remember what porosity is full of pores. That is, having minute interstices through which water, air, light, etc. may pass. And in Naples, it is precisely this porous threshold between interior and exterior space, between private and public, between civic and religious life, between center and periphery, between village life and big city life. And here's the quote: "As porous as this stone is the architecture. Building and action interpenetrate." One would want to have to look at the German for that verb, interpenetration, "in the courtyards, arcades, and stairway. In everything, they preserve the scope to become a theater of new, unforeseen constellations." Okay? Constellations are absolutely crucial to Benjamin. They emerge from, actually, Mallarmé's Un coup de dé. They are reapplied in the Trauerspiel book. This is the constant sort of reorganization of the sky into new, readable, allegorical, personified forms. The stamp, and this continues, "the stamp of the definitive is avoided. No situation appears, indeed, as forever. No situation appears as intended forever. No figure asserts its, quote, thus and otherwise." What he is going at in Naples is, in fact, improvisation. is one of the great tropes about Italy, you know. Madame de Stael's Corinne ou l'Italie is about a woman who is an improviser, right? And what fascinates him in Moscow in late 26, 27 is that everything is provisional. Everything is improvisational, especially as they relate to means of production. And he cites, maybe you as a Russian have a full sense of the Russian semantics of this French word. He's there in Russia in the period of the remonte.
Remonte,
right?
Yes.
But which is a borrowed a loan word, right?
Yeah, but we operate with this as if it is our DNA. Yeah, it became.
Is this still in the Russian vocabulary
every day,
today?
Everyday basis.
So yeah. What does
nothing
it mean?
Nothing changed. It means under construction. Under construction.
Under construction. And that's what he sees in Naples is something going back to the traditional Italian notion of, improvisatore, of improvising. And it is a theater of improvisation. For example, there's this incredible text in the Naples essay that having to do with architecture. Maybe this is relevant to both of your experiences. One can scarcely discern where building is still in progress and where dilapidation has already set in. Huh? The absolute reciprocity between constructivity and ruination. Huh? He continues, for nothing is concluded, and porosity results not only from the indolence of the southern artisan, but above all from the passion for improvisation when demands that space and opportunity be at any price preserved. I think Benjamin's view of this moment in Moscow, late 26, early 27, as a kind of a late and a fated to be eliminated by the rise of Stalinism, as sort of he's seeing the last gasps of improvisation. And in the Moscow diary, he relates to remonte, this incredible sense of people are always rearranging their furniture in their houses. You know, this is no longer the absolutely stuffy bourgeois intérieur, but there are so few pieces of furniture that what you do is you move it around as part of the remonte, just as like everything in Moscow is constantly moving around. All of the various institutions and state agencies and so on. And this is why Benjamin is completely lost at every moment, because this city is still absolutely mobile, and nothing is yet decided. And that's the real link between, at least in his mind, this kind of southern Neapolitan, sense of improvisation, and nothing is fixed, and actually the real possibilities of Moscow, just before the goddamn curtain comes down with Stalinization, right? And this is the whole NEP period and so on and so forth. But
I wanted to just throw out
One other question. I know that our time is quickly passing us by. You know, you've all spoken so sensitively and so with such complexity about the diary. Mm-hmm. Alexandra, you had just invoked Berlin childhood around 1900 and how it almost begins in one city, ends up in another. So to you, Richard had invoked how the diary is a path through a landscape of events that links Naples, Moscow, and so many other cities. I guess a question that Ksenia and I have been really invested in is, like, what doesn't translate across other contexts and landscapes? And I mean, one word that I've been really invested in Moscow, we talked a lot about, was the word "has been." You translated it as "has been," and this was a word that Benjamin invokes to describe individuals who have struggled to keep up with the revolutionary change happening in society. And that seems to me a word that, while it might have applicability to other societies, it seems like so specific to that NEP era moment in Moscow. And I wonder if either that word or other kind of terms or concepts might not translate so well, and how it was to translate the diary, but also by extension to Alexandra and Ksenia, if there are other terms or concepts that really resist translation across urban landscapes and geographies and languages.
Ooh,
tough.
Well, I've been arguing for the translatability, going from that 1913 essay through Naples.
And our project is all about translatability.
Through yeah. Moscow, and you're asking those moments of real resistances to translatability. As Benjamin, having flirted with this romance with Moscow, which is at the same time his romance with Agelasis, where does translatability end within the Benjamin corpus, whether it be among all of the various cities that he writes about in his Städtebilder, which I think increasingly critics most recently, like Andreas Riesen, have seen as kind of a single corpus.
Or maybe I'd even pose the
translatability okay. actually ends with Benjamin's dream of mobility. And sorry, that's the story of, the very, very sad story of Benjamin's exilic mobility that moves from Capri to Ibiza, to San Remo, to at the beginning, even a place called Dachau, which is a kind of a nice holiday suburb of Munich. Translatability, I would say, biographically, ends this dream of improvisatory mobility, right? Actually is historically and objectively happens when everything closes down on Benjamin, including the border at Portbou, which by his own particular kind of bad luck closed down on one day, opened up subsequently, and as a result of this suicide pact with Arthur Koestler, Benjamin, takes the poison. Koestler does not, but I mean, you see it later, and so that actually physical domain of translatability you know, as he's in Paris, in ever poorer circumstances, is put in Drancy in an actual concentration camp. I mean, let's not forget that. Let's not forget that in terms of the... And what's left in the late thesis on the philosophy of history is you know, some sort of messianic dream of a space in which everything would eventually be, and for transmissible and translatable. And transmissibility in Benjamin, in a very deeply Jewish sense, is always related to translatability, you know, the transmission.
Indeed, of the text. In a sense, one could say that porosity is the equivalent of translation.
Yeah.
If you have porous spaces, they can exchange their fluids.
And it's by these small interstices, which is that very small messianic era area and possibility in which finally, you know, some sort of redemption will be installed. But I mean, to your question, I mean, I would want to be just, you know, objectively and historically materialist in terms of sort of the way in which transmission and translation close down on him. Right.
And I think at least you've proved that this can be translated, since you translated it so well. So we have the translation. Yeah. But I think there are many, many questions that I guess some of us would like to ask. Mm-hmm. What remains is this extraordinary text in which you have both a sort of sharpness of observation and a delusion about so many things. Poor Benjamin took some time to realize that his main friend, interpreter Bernard Reich, was also Aja Leisch's companion and future husband, which, you know, it's really weird to realize that it's only at the end that he sees that. Oh, he wants to spend so many hours with her alone. And so it's something that I find in all of Benjamin's texts, that amazing power of conceptual density and expression allied with things that seemed a little off at times or miss certain things. And this is what I'd like to ask you. In my experience as a reader, what remains is a sense of pathos, melancholia, longing. There's the sense of longing. How does he achieve that? Is it something you've thought about?
Well, I mean, if you look at the recent biography of Benjamin by Peter Jennings and Howard Island, from the very beginning, Benjamin has a genius for impossible triangular relations. They are absolutely his structural need. I mean, not to get Girardian, you know, on you all, but he goes into this in absolute knowledge of the triangulation. He has a triangular relationship with his wife Dora and Yulia Rod. He has any number of most of his romantic, erotic relationships are absolutely based on the structure of triangular mediation, right? Which in itself is very interesting to think about. It's not like he discovered it at the end. He went in there knowing this. And in a way, he needs this impossibility of the triangular mediation, which reproduces itself in all of his, I mean, even, you know, with Gertrude Adorno's wife, right? I mean, it's there. And in a way, the structure of triangulation will guarantee his deepest need, which is the need to mourn. And even the need to mourn in anticipation of loss, right? And I think if we scratch the surface of his theory of the diary and this death of the individual and its resurrection and so on and so forth, I mean, the diary is in fact a mode of elegy in the present, of lamentation in the present, in which the both futural loss and, in fact, the loss of the past, you know, is always there. And I mean, and what is so important about the relationship to Asialathus is, by definition, she is the lost object.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well done.
Huh?
Well done.
Yeah, I just, if I may, I wanted to add a few things about the translation and in a way of transcending also, transcending meanings. Yeah, and this incredible attention to instability of the city and therefore its power also unveils in his super vivid cultural trope, such as that is also connected with Rimont, the idea of and the concept of a surface, the mm-hmm. surface of the city. Yeah, what's mm-hmm. the surface of the city for him? Mm-hmm. It's always unstable. Mm-hmm. It's always either a mix of the liquidish mud and snow, or it is a reversible logic of an interior coming out to an exterior because of Rimont. It's parquet that is outside mm-hmm. On the sidewalks, yeah, because the buildings are.
But since you talk about surface, what's really nice? No. What's really nice is what he says at the beginning of his Moscow essay for Buber is that. The instant one arrives, the childhood stage begins on the thick sheet of ice of the street. Walking has to be relearned.
Yes.
This is his initial experience of this regressive universe of that. It's the surface, not to have interrupted you, but I mean, is just totally slick. He cannot even walk. He is like a child who needs to learn how to gain purchase, right? And his entire experience in Moscow is that of an infans, of someone who cannot talk, who cannot understand Russian, and who is therefore reduced to slipping and sliding and trying to find his way around and try to understand the films and try to understand what the debate is about Meyerhold's, you know, inspector general, you know, and his only person who's there as his translator is Reich. Right? But this is very, because we haven't talked about toys yet, but in fact, Moscow, like hashish in Marseille, is actually a very productive regression to the state of the infants, of the pre-linguistic, right? And the most powerful moments in the diary with Asialathus is, I mean, and one is very confused why she should have been, you know, his huge intellectual mentor in matters communist and in matters leftist and in matters leading him into Brecht, because, you know, his record of their conversations are incredibly banal. I mean, they have like one big conversation where Benjamin is suggesting, you know, we should really analyze the role of the grand piano in the bourgeois interior, you know, and she's, oh, wow, that's great. But, you know, his real interlocutor is Reich, and And what goes on with osteolysis is only purely gestural. I mean, the strongest moment at the end of the diary where they're kissing and finally they join palms together, right? The electricity from this, right? And this is gestus, and this is then, you know, theater and gesture, not only in Naples, the city of the great semiotics of gesture, but also Brecht's theater as quotable gesture. But, I mean, his relationship to Lassus throughout this text is not verbal, but gestural, right? And again, we're back into infants, and of course, she does children's theater, right? I mean, that's what she does. And anyway, we could do a whole kind of cut through Moscow diary on
the
sort of children.
We need to do a second session.
Jam session.
we promised we would have a moment of Q&A briefly. So if anybody here has a question, this is the moment. Otherwise, we'll reschedule something because we started the discussion. Has anybody? Yes. Okay, I see.
Just to make it short, because I can't say everything that I would like to for sake of time, but I'm since I was introduced to Benjamin's work, it was really through the context of his political philosophy and significance for political thinking, and obviously it was no accident that Benjamin's thought would have appeared, you know, when it did for you in the University of Chicago in 1969, very much representative of his observation and thesis on the philosophy of history, that history kind of wells up in moments of political crisis of when it's needed most. So certainly when you think of Benjamin in Moscow, unavoidably the significance of this intellectual in a revolutionary society is something that's that I would be very interested in. And so when Alexandra discussed the more recent critique that Benjamin was in fact a privileged Western intellectual in this foreign land, imposing more or less his own idealization on the society, basically as a kind of stooge for the Communist Party, if I take the kind of strong form of your criticism to its extent, then I really wonder where that leaves us, whether or not that's not playing into the forgetfulness of a revolutionary history of possibilities that have since been squashed and obliterated prematurely. And if there's something still that resonates for the political Walter Benjamin in the Moscow Diaries, some of this has been alluded to already, but that's, I guess, what's on my mind, and I wanted to know if you thought that there's anything really, you know, still kicking there for people interested in politics.
Appreciate your observation. First, just to make a little something clear, where you felt it might have been my critique, it was really Catherine Clark, because she leads us to go that way, not because of dislike of Benjamin, just trying to put it in a little bit different context and make a different kind of assertion. But the reason that led me to offer you a parallel tale was not, believe me, to compete with the beauty of the original diary, but maybe to invoke something that was there at one time, and I don't know how it is today. You might. There was a moment when you could come to a particular kind of a country, and the arrival will be precisely as I described. It will have many, many different variations, but you would be hosted, you would be held, you would be observed, you would not know, and this was the guided tour of the place. You needed, literally, at least in 1989 still, maybe it was very different in 1991 or 1995 or doesn't exist today, you were in somebody's hand, and that person became an interesting, not only interlocutor, but medium through whom something happened that would not have happened otherwise with somebody else. And And there is something to be said about that mediated experience and about the struggle for the non-mediated experience that I'm sure Benjamin was after. Because there was the infant moment, love what you said, of not speaking, of not hearing properly, of meaninglessness of the universe. And then there was the other kind of quest that I believe was there, and that is in the diary. And that is, what about the immediateness of experience? Which might be the reason that certain visual moments are so powerful in the diary, because no translation is needed there. You are asking much more delicate question about the relevance and survival of certain kind of politics and enthusiasm. I heard you very well. I cannot respond to that. Maybe somebody else can, but...
Well, he's actually very critical, both in the Moscow essay that was later published and in the diary if you remember, he's been commissioned to write an article on Goethe for the Soviet Encyclopedia. And in this edition, you have Lunacharsky's reading of Benjamin's essay on Goethe, which is of a... high ideological idiocy that you would not believe. And he was there. I mean, Reich was trying to get him involved with, okay, and it's a whole question for Benjamin, what does it mean for an independent, threatened, marginal, outrider intellectual to actually accept a post within the institution? Right? So, I mean, I'd like to rephrase your question about Benjamin and politics in terms of Benjamin and institutions, right? Subsequently, he has a very complex and very uneasy relationship with the Institute for Sozialforschung, you know, which is the Frankfurt School, with Horkheimer above all, you know, which is where he ends up, which is where he gets some sort of institutional... support as someone who was, you know, rejected from the institution of the university, whose life was basically that of a freelance public intellectual, who was seeing actually the withering up of gradually over the 30s of all the possibilities of indeed publishing. So, I mean. Actually, in the Moscow Diary, it's very, very interesting the meditations that he has about what would be my relationship toward an institution and toward Soviet institutions, which are in fact in the service of the proletariat. And frankly, he flinches. He flinches deeply because actually he's seeing how the only piece that you know he's actually been commissioned to do has been totally ground to bits by kind of the official ideological sort of idiocies as embodied by Lunacharsky at that moment. More complexly, we would want to take Benjamin into his relationship to Brecht, right? Whom he meets through Reich and Lossis, finally in 29, you know, has an incredibly deep and complex relationship. And then we want to talk about sort of Brecht's also simultaneous flinching away from Moscow. Remember, Reich and Lossis go back to Moscow, and both are disappeared into camps and only reemerge in the mid-50s, right? This is also the case of another close Benjamin friend whose name is escaping me. So he saw from a distance the way in which these institutions and this system were actually grinding up, let's call them antinomian intellectuals, and so on and so forth, but including the two people in this story when you kind of follow the post-history of this. I mean...
But also the phenomenon of Moscow Diary in today's political agenda. It's definitely a politically charged document. Yeah, and the phenomenon of its enormous success within today's Russian Soviet Moscow intelligentsia, or even larger in the hipster culture, is a question mark for us. Yeah, when we started this project, it was a marginal text. It was a text for an incredibly selected amount of reading intellectuals who were also able to read it in various languages, in German and English. They had access to October. However, they would prefer to read it in Russian just because of the afterwards of the philosopher, yeah, and in order also to have an additional layer of this third language. And a recent translation, in addition, and the publication supported by the largest center of contemporary art, Garage, it started to be a hipster literature. Every second young person in the subway, Moscow subway, is reading Moscow Diary. So it's much more than even a Agatha Christie book. it has a different dimension. So what stands behind that boom? Yeah, is it somehow related to today's political agenda? What is it about? Yeah, so that's my question. If we are to zoom out from this kind of personal reading.
To conclude, thank you, all of you. You've been wonderful.